Hello, everybody. In this episode of Geekery and Wine, The Stanley Parable, Plantaze Snegorsky Vernach, and A Journey to Nerdopolis. So grab your lanyard and laminated con badge, and for gosh sakes, listen to the disembodied narrator's voice as we plunge into another episode of Geekery and Wine. The Geek Side, The Stanley Parable. This installment is a lovely throwback for me. As I've said in earlier episodes, first-person shooters have always been my favorite computer game genre. I mean, I think I could say that I started with Doom or even Wolfenstein 3D, but that wouldn't tell the whole story, because actually, what started my love of this genre was Tunnels of Doom. Yep, that grand old warhorse. The Texas Instruments 99-4A was my first computer, and Tunnels of Doom did have you traversing hallways in fabulous 3D. They weren't great hallways, but still. There were dragons that looked largely like big seahorses with side wings, but they were cool. It was 1982, man. But back to the Stanley Parable. This game itself is a mod of the Half-Life 2 engine, so I was already expecting good things. And it is first person, yes. But a shooter? Hardly. You are an office worker named Stanley. I mean, who doesn't want to be one of those in a computer game, right? This is what we all dream of when we game. Ninjas and superheroes are so last week. And as you begin to traverse your day as an average office drone, everything is narrated by a VOG, or Voice of God, narrator. And right away, you're thinking, but that means I have to do what he's saying, right? Nope. When you diverge from his narrations, he changes the narrative to backwardly justify what he has already said. It is wonderfully silly. Another thing that I absolutely love about this game is that it is short. And don't get me wrong, I loves me some games with grand scope, where after 60 hours there are still amazing adventures to be had and achievements to unlock. But I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago. There are kids and a wife that all have stuff to do. And that means I can't hide away for 60-plus hours of uninterrupted computer gaming. Therefore, I have a deep and abiding appreciation for a game that hops in there, entertains me, and then gives me the feeling of a fulfilling narrative. Perhaps my best comparison would be other visual media. I love a good TV series that takes its time exploring elements of the characters that I can binge, or even stretch out my enjoyment of said universe. Take Gilmore Girls, the series that ran on the WB and CW from 2000 to 2007 and was revived on Netflix in 2016. Loved it. But I also have a big love for a film that can create a universe, tell a yarn, and then be done. I have no idea why, but Event Horizon is hopping into my mind for some reason. Now, what a romantic comedy TV series centering on a mother-daughter relationship and an outer space Cthulhu story of cosmic horror have in common is anyone's guess. But get in, entertain, and get out is what the Stanley Parable does in a wacky, WTF is happening kind of way. It also took what was, at the time, a method of adventure that was cliched and overly relied on its tropes. When you took up the mantle of the character behind their eyes, you took for granted that your life would be an action film. In the Stanley Parable, this expectation is subverted with an existential dread you need to grapple with. A computer game that actually causes you to think about your life. I think there should be a primal scream here. What follows is a section that might be a bit spoilerish, so proceed with caution. As the protagonist, Stanley, you begin to see that there may be more going on in your dreary office than what you had originally thought. The office you are in is deserted by design, which I think is absolutely clever. Considering this was released in 2013, and making convincing animated co-stars was difficult, to say the least. Here is an interesting tidbit. I was recently online doing a bit of research about the Stanley Parable for this episode, and found out that the game is going to be re-released in an Ultimate Edition that will also be available on consoles. And even though I am not usually one to rebuy something I have already had the experience of... wait. We are a geek nation of reboots and sequels, prequels, and probably equals too. Never mind, I totally am someone who rebuys the experience I have already had and enjoyed. Carry on. Right. I will probably see what the Stanley Parable, the Ultimate Edition, will be like on Xbox. And if it is like the current incarnation, which features mind control, mythical significant others, and long walks into the sunset and uneasy peace of mind, I think it will be totally worth it. The Wine Side, Plantaze Snogorski Vranach. I would love to say there was some deep abiding spiritual reason for the wine I chose for this episode, but honestly, I just like the weird. So when I was looking for a wine to talk about, I originally started looking for interesting Israeli wines and found many of them to be Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. And I glanced to the right on the shelf and found Plantaze Snogorski Vranach. In a world, hang on, I can do that better. In a world, there we go. In a world of Merlots, Cabernet Sauvignons, Zinfandels, etc., I was drawn to a varietal that I don't think I would be able to pronounce without looking up a few things on YouTube. This wine comes from Montenegro in the Balkans. I chose it mostly because it reminds me of a friend I haven't spoken to in a long time. My friend Zach. He and his wife moved to Bosnia and taught at some of the schools used by diplomats' kids overseas, and then moved to China and adopted a son. Well, as is often the case, when people live a long ways away, we drifted. And his new son became endlessly fascinating to him, and I don't blame him. I was a little jealous. For a long time, he was that trusted intellectual confidant that you talk about the deep, weighty issues with. And I miss him. I still see him on Facebook doing things with his family, but I miss the really long emails, the conversations we used to have together. It's always hard moving on, and in a lot of ways, I guess I just don't want to. So I found this wine that is probably grown 163 miles from where he used to live. Long sigh tinged with ennui. In other geek news, it's also a 3-hour drive from where the wine was made to where the Red Viper met his end at the hands of the Mountain in Game of Thrones. At least where it was filmed in the series, anyhow. Weird coincidence. A strange thing happened to me when I went down to the basement to look at the bottle. I found it actually was from 2013. Is there some vast intelligence that knew this? Is there some all-powerful narrator who is guiding my actions while I am narrating this blog? Would it be amazing if it actually was Kevin Brighting, the dude who narrated the Stanley Parable? Wait, that was the last section. We should probably take a hard left and talk about how I experience my wine. This is not an easily answered question. It's a bit more nuanced. And this is true of most wines I drink. The first 5-ounce pour may be a bit much for me, especially the big Barolos or Cabs. All I can taste is the alcohol or maybe the big pucker of a particularly sour note. The second 5-ounce pour, I'm getting used to the flavors and finding nuances. But the third, it doesn't usually taste very good. The wine begins to lose something. I think my taste buds are starting to get anesthetized, and it's not as pleasurable to me as it was when I started. Vranach tastes very green to me. There is something akin to a slight bitterness one might taste in a banana that wasn't quite as yellow as it should be. Think the tart taste of a cranberry, but with the finish of an olive. So, just like its name, Vranach is different from the other wines I came across. Those finishing notes hang with the wine into the second glass, too. BT dubs, a complete bottle of wine is about 5 5-ounce glasses. If I ever were to sit down and finish a bottle over the course of an evening, it would have to be something like a Chateauneuf du Pape, while watching a lot of something on TV and snacking a bunch. Vranach is not that wine, though. Which means, also very importantly, is how the wine is on the second day. And I mean without any pumping out of the air or ceiling and whatnot. Some wines will lose all their zazz on the second day, whereas others actually mellow, or just flat-out improve. Vranach stays very consistent. On the second day, it is very like the wine I had the day before, which for me means it is a nice weekday wine that can be enjoyed over the course of several dinners. I bought Plantaze Snagorsky Vrenache for $11.99 at New Hampshire Wine and Liquor Outlet. But you can find it online at PotomacWines.com for... $7.99. Ugh, give me a break. Ah, but wait. It seems they don't ship to Massachusetts. Well, fine. Audio goodness. A journey to Nerdopolis, or how I did San Diego Comic-Con. Well, this was going to be different. To be very frank, I was petrified to put myself out there. Reading someone else's work is easy. Emotionally. I would connect with the piece and perform it, but ultimately it's not mine. I could always say of a bad review, "Well, it was the author's writing the listener had a problem with, not me." On some websites, the review is even broken down by performance, story, and overall rating. Another concern is that after a creative piece is out in the world, it is a permanent statement of the author. At least that is how it is perceived. And there was no sense that it would be listened to within the context of the other writing and work I'd done. What about when my ideas on any subject progress and change? What then? Ugh, and why did I include the date? Why did I let Scott, my cover artist, put the date on the cover? Ugh, fine, fine, fine. Why did I instruct him to put the date on the cover? Because that's what I said in the audiobook. All of these things ping-ponged around my brain as I decided whether or not now was the time to actually narrate a piece of my own writing. On one hand, I can absolutely attest to and support the opinion that very few authors are able to read their own work well. There are exceptions, of course. The great and good Neil Gaiman comes to mind. But most of the time, it can be pretty dreadful. You're asking someone to do a one-person show, play all the characters, and do so with little to no acting training. That's not particularly fair. Are there some naturals? Of course. The aforementioned Neil Gaiman is one. Anne Lamott reading her book Bird by Bird is another. But mostly it's painful, and one can feel either the desire to do good that is not coupled with the much-needed skill set, or the straight-up dread the author has for performing. Someone made me do this, but I don't wanna. Neither is something you want to spend a great deal of time with in your ears. Here's why. As an author, you are looking at how the machine works. Are the plot points coming together in a way that makes sense? Are all of the characters arcing in a way that makes the reader care about them? Yet, as an actor, I have but a single job. Render the character that is currently front and center honestly. And when the next character comes into scene, do it again. And keep doing it until you get to the part of the text that says, "The end." I mean, there are funny voices, oodles of things regarding working with microphones, and on, but the truth in performance is at the core. What if the Chekhov's gun in Act 1 is still unused in Act 3? Not my problem. What if my conflict with a minor character is still unresolved by the end of the book? Someone else's job. I liken this to the race car driver and the mechanic. Can mechanics be good race car drivers? Sure. But these are radically different skill sets, and each is focusing on different things while using them. Now, after I narrated my piece, I listened to it with a theater director's critical ear. But with my own work, I wonder if I am not more subdued than another narrator might be, because I am so familiar with it. Am I still able to bring across the illusion of the first time, that theatrical notion that this is the first time these events have spontaneously taken place? But here is another thought. I was at that point in my career when I hadn't nurtured any relationships with publishers. No one was going to lay a high-value property in my lap with only 10 or so titles under my belt. So I had to take advantage of the unique access to the author that is me. So, I was hired by me to read me. And if I owned the rights to the song "I Am My Own Grandpa," I'd play it here. I spoke a little about the difficulties in writing A Journey to Nerdopolis, actually in the text. It was this. If I'm being intellectually honest, and how could I not be with you, dear listener? It is really hard for me to write about the first instance of an amazing experience in isolation, because it is, usually, in repeating the experience that I find out what my opinion is. Nerdopolis was actually written about my second visit to Comic-Con International.
Hang on. Even with wine, is this the case?
Yes, absolutely. I didn't intentionally have a vertical tasting in the last episode. I had a vertical tasting because when I went back to get more, the vintage had changed.
As an aside to the aside, I probably won't be doing a tasting of a $500 bottle of wine from 1972 because I really, really want to write about Pong for that very reason. Side quest. I decided to check out exactly what it might take to have a wine from 1972, and I found a 1972 Chateau Saint-Georges Bordeaux for $142.64 at SauDevin.com. So that's all it would cost me to talk about Pong? Wait, they don't ship to Massachusetts. If I still lived in Colorado, they would, though. Drat. End side quest. As well as the aside to the aside of the original aside. So, now I wonder, as I contemplate this work both in its print and audio form, am I tiring of the Comic-Con scene? The original title was A Journey to Nerdopolis, or How I Did San Diego Comic-Con 2013. 2013? And then the audio came out in 2014. The Kindle single came out in 2018, and I'm talking about the experience of it a year later. I've attended countless conventions in the intervening time. Or is it the con scene in general that's becoming tiresome? That can't be. The big conventions still grow and sell out every year. It must be me. When I found the theater teacher conventions tiring in the middle of my teaching career, I knew it was time to become an instructor at those same conventions. I'd heard what my mentors had to say many times, and now knew I had to help others get where I was now. And I can't help but feel that this is where I'm at. Not only as a pop culture fan, but as a narrator, too. I think I need to add to the conversation. Find A Journey to Nerdopolis, or How I Did San Diego Comic-Con, and all of my audiobooks at lastwordaudio.com. They're also available at audible.com, iTunes, and Amazon Digital Download. If you've been loving Geekery and Wine, let some folks know by writing a review in Apple Podcasts. It helps other folk to find the show. I tweet at Colby Elliott, and you can find Last Word Audio on Facebook. Next time on Geekery and Wine. A Wolf Among Us. Monte Antico, Toscana. And Sly Flourishes, the Lazy Dungeon Master. So until then, my geeks, my nerds, my dear, dear friends, adieu.